Hello and welcome to the British Chambers podcast channel. We're delighted to bring you a second season of in-depth discussions and conversations with our members and high-profile speakers, ranging from topics like trade, fintech, arts, sports, and more within Singapore, ASEAN, and the UK. Thank you for your support, and we hope you enjoy today's podcast. With 10 categories, 10 winners, and one big night of celebrating the best of business excellence, entries are now open for the British Chamber's 22nd Annual Business Awards. As Singapore's longest-running awards by an international chamber, categories range from Employer of the Year, Diversity and Inclusion Champion of the Year, Sustainability Champion of the Year, through to UK Exporter of the Year, and more. For all the details and how to submit your entries, visit www.britcham.org.sg. Hello and welcome to this episode of In Conversation with me, David Kelly. With knowledge and education being one of the core pillars of the SG UK Partnership for the Future, today's podcast theme is all about education. Brighton College are partners of the British Chamber of Commerce here in Singapore, and with the recent launch of the Chamber's Education and Learning Hub, I'm absolutely delighted to be welcomed by today's guest, who's the Deputy Head of Brighton College in Singapore, Lois Pugh. Lois joined Brighton College in Singapore following 4 years spent as head of school at North London Collegiate School in Jeju in South Korea. During her time there, she oversaw the growth of the school from 150 pupils to just short of 400, integrating a dual language program in the infant and junior school, as well as subject specialisms in years 5 and 6. Lois has held leadership and management roles at outstanding prep schools in the UK, including deputy headship at the winner of the UK Prep School of the Year in 2018, and more recently at Handcross Park, a member of the Brighton College family of schools and UK Prep School of the Year in 2019 too. Lois holds a BSc honours degree in zoology from the University of St Andrews, a postgraduate certificate in education, and the national professional qualification for headship. She moved to Singapore in January 2020 and is currently teaching the most senior pupils in year four, as well as overseeing the curriculum across the pre-prep and prep schools as well. Lois, it's great to have you with us. Thank you so much for your time today. A very warm welcome to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you moved to Singapore in 2020. I mean, wow, talk about timing. Yeah, that must have been an interesting time. How has it been over the last 12 months or so?
It's been in quite a journey, as you say. So I arrived literally about 2 months before the first lockdown happened. And I think I always expected it was going to be a bit of a crazy year founding a school from scratch. But I didn't quite expect that it would be exactly as it has been. But it's just been the most amazing experience. I think everything that we're currently going through in education at the moment and around the world has really made us think about how we do things, how we can do things differently. So it's just been a tremendous experience, and even better than the idea of a founding school was in the first place.
Fabulous. And so, just to go back right to the beginning, you studied zoology at the University of St Andrews before moving into teaching. And What was it that attracted you to teaching in the first place? And, you know, is there something you can tell our listeners a little bit about that sort of jump from zoology into the world of education?
I can. It wasn't an informed decision at all. It was like some of the, I suppose, best kind of plans end up being, it was a complete accident. So I was up in St Andrews doing zoology. I loved all aspects of science, but particularly kind of conservation, looking at animals, things like that. I decided to take a year out between my second year completion and starting my third, and I went traveling. And I went all over the world, kind of going from different conservation projects to different conservation projects. I spent a lot of time at SeaWorld, looking at their marine mammal kind of project there. And I kind of went back to university after that year and decided that the one thing I had learned was that I didn't want to be in an office. I didn't want to be in a lab all day. I wanted to do something where every day was different. And so I got to the end of my degree, not really knowing what I wanted to do. My parents said, "You're not going traveling again because that costs way too much money." And so I actually decided to, I think, to buy myself some time. And I went over to the United States. I lived in Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. in Arlington. And I was a nanny. And I was a nanny for a family who were both teachers. And I spent 2 years with them. And over my time there, they kept saying to me, have you ever thought about being a teacher? Like, we think you'd be a great teacher. And I kept going, oh, that sounds awful. No, I don't really want to do that. And then in the end, they said it to me so much that I thought, oh, you know, well, I do love children. I love science. I wonder if I could combine the two. So I started going into one of the people I lived with. I started going into their high school, actually, and absolutely loved it. I was doing some volunteer stuff there. And then I made the decision that I would go back to the UK and I would train to be a secondary science teacher, actually. So that's how I first got into teaching. And then from the moment I started, it was just that moment of, I can't believe I ever thought about doing anything else. So I started as a secondary science teacher in state schools. And what I really missed, actually, was having been in American schools, I really missed all the extra stuff that they do as a given. So all the sport, all the kind of societies, all that kind of holistic bits and pieces that I didn't see as much of in this kind of state secondaries I was working at up in Yorkshire, where I'm from. And so I started looking at prep schools. And so where I could combine both that environment, but also my love of science. And I was offered a position at an absolutely idyllic prep school in Suffolk. And I moved there. And that's how it kind of really started and where my move into prep education as opposed to secondary education started.
So how did you get onto the international scene and how did you start sort of teaching internationally? How did that sort of take shape?
Yeah, so I was in prep schools then for the first kind of 5-6 years of my career, and kind of absolutely loved getting stuck in. And I worked my way up from kind of being a teacher to then being a head of department to then being a deputy head. I did an awful lot of retraining, particularly in the early years and in primary education, because obviously I was secondary trained originally. And got really interested in the kind of beginning journey. And then I just got to the point where I was so happy in the school that I was in that I knew that I was never, ever going to leave unless I did something, I suppose, quite big and brave. And I was my own personal situation. I was on my own. I didn't have to worry about anyone else. And I thought, actually, you know, I'm going to think about going internationally. I've loved it when I traveled. And so I just saw a job advertised with NLCS, and I knew the school well, and it was in Korea, and I hadn't even been to Asia before, never mind Korea. And so I thought, oh, I'll apply and see how I get on. And I got it, and it was a head of school position, so it was a step up from where I was. What they needed fit with a lot of what was my, I suppose, speciality, my love. They needed a lot of work with curriculum and things like that. And it just turned out because of the timings that I was accepted into the role. And then within about 8 or 10 weeks, I was on a plane to Korea, kind of going, goodness, what on earth am I doing? And that was that. And then since then, I think being in international teaching gives an extra kind of added dimension, an extra bit of excitement that you, as a teacher, I think being a teacher is exciting anyway, but then that adds a little bit extra to it as well. We've dabbled with kind of going home. We have been home for a period before I started this job so I could work in Brighton Group, but back out again now.
Oh, brilliant. And just, you know, I mean, in Singapore, certainly, you know, English is sort of first taught language and it feels like it's sort of almost Asia for beginners in a sort of way, isn't it, from moving to the UK? But South Korea must have been a bit more challenging. So was there a sort of a cultural difference there, or are you sort of in that international school bubble where actually sort of the culture doesn't sort of permeate in that sort of environment? How did that sort of work?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the role that I had in career was a huge culture shock. So the school that I was at is actually on the island of Jeju, which is off the coast of Korea, and was originally a very traditional farming community where they've done a very interesting project of putting international schools there. So it's a real juxtaposition between being in the education city, as they called it, and outside of it. So yeah, I mean, huge culture shock, amazing experience, but you know, you definitely can't go and get the cheese that you're used to getting. You can't go and get a Mexican, you know, in the middle of the night. You couldn't even get in a taxi and get home without having a translated card. So, you know, I think a really amazing opportunity to do that. And the school actually had 95% Korean students. So you were, which was very interesting, because then you're trying to do an international education, a global education, but actually you're dealing not with an international community, you're dealing with a community that actually is predominantly, you know, one culture, which is different to most of the educators. So, yeah, I think an amazing experience.
Can you just sort of tell our listeners about, because I think it's really, really interesting around the dual language program that you put in the infant and junior school in South Korea. How did that come about, and what did it look like, and what were some of the challenges sort of putting that in place?
Yeah, I mean, actually, it was trilingual in the end, because the way that we worked is we had, as I said, predominantly our children were Korean, so 90 to 95% Korean. We also had a number of Chinese students, and so also needed to look at their first language provision. And then we had our other students, our staff children, and children from you know, a mixture of other Asian countries. And obviously the language of the school was English, and that was our academic kind of language. So we had this really interesting situation where we had children joining our nursery class who couldn't speak a word of English. They were being taught by people who only spoke English. And we wanted to make sure that they kept their mother tongue language to a certain level, as well as being able to access the curriculum of a selective school, an academically selective school. So what we did is we staffed our school to make sure that we had our British educators in there, alongside Korean, native Korean speakers, alongside Mandarin speakers, and each person within the room had a very specific role. And so our Koreans, they spoke Korean to them all the time and repeated things that the English speaker would say. The same was true of our Mandarin speaker. And small children are amazing. I mean, that is the best way to do it. And you ended up with this really spectacular situation where you would see them on the playground with each other and they'd be switching between the languages. And I think when you see the power of doing it from that age, before then kind of moving into, okay, now let's make a push towards the English or, you know, whatever you decide to do as a school, you see the real benefits, as opposed to trying to teach children who are even just a few years older. So it's a really special way of doing it, in a way that the children are almost immersed in it without even realizing that they're learning. It's just part of their environment.
So is that one of the main drivers of you getting into primary education sort of rather than secondary education, I guess, sort of seeing that sort of early learning years and that development and that opportunity and the impact that you have on younger lives?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's pros of both sides. I mean, there's also something very special about, you know, getting a secondary school child to, you know, the place that they want to go. I think, you know, as an educator, it doesn't really matter so much about their age. I think it's more about that process. However, for me, it's the prep school thing, actually. It's that kind of idea of taking a child at such a kind of formative stage of their education and really being able to shape their foundations and to put them on the right path and to give them everything that they possibly need to then, you know, specialise in whatever area they want to in secondary and beyond.
So I mean, I guess just bringing you back to Singapore and your role at Brighton College here in Singapore, which I believe is a selective school. A bit of a silly question, but for those that might not be aware of what a selective school is, can you just sort of talk about what are the benefits of sending a child to a selective school and some of the opportunities that present themselves that are available to them and certainly to help parents to make their mind up as well on making those decisions within schools.
Yeah, sure. I think. The most important thing for parents to know is that selective to one school may be completely different to what another school may mean by selective. For us at Brighton, I would say that selective actually means that we take an awful lot of care over our admissions process. So it doesn't mean that we're necessarily looking for a child who can reach this level in maths or this level in English or this level in science. Right. What we're looking for is a child who shows great potential to thrive in our environment. So we know that our curriculum is appropriately challenging. We know that we're busy. So all of our children from year one upwards have specialist teaching in an awful lot of subjects. That means that it's a very busy day. We're going, you know, here, there, and everywhere. And there are some children who really thrive in that environment and love it. And there are other children who actually need to be kind of in a classroom with one person for all of their subjects. And that's absolutely fine as well. So I think for us and for a parent, if you've got a child who is really inquisitive, really curious, really interested in the world around them, and you think that they would benefit from that real depth and breadth of kind of subject knowledge and really, really high expectations and, you know, an appropriate level of challenge, that's certainly what we do here, alongside giving them as just part of the curriculum, all the sport, all the music, all the drama, all the art. That's just part of what we do. It's not an extra. It is in our curriculum.
So Singapore is such a diverse place, right? I mean, and it's very, very transient. How do you create an educational program that is well-rounded for your pupils? If, you know, from that perspective, how do you create that environment of learning that allows everybody to thrive, where people come from lots of different backgrounds?
Yeah, and I think that's why being selective actually is really important to us, because we are getting children all the time that have had very, very different experiences. And I think, I see every single child who comes to the school and possibly wants to join us. And I think that's why you can't just have a number that we're expecting a child to reach, because actually every single child's background is different. So we've had children joining us this year who obviously haven't been in school for a year. And that may mean that they haven't been taught any phonics or they haven't been taught how to read. But we have a very special way of kind of meeting the children, assessing them, if you like, the activities that we do with them to go, okay, well, it doesn't necessarily matter that they've not been taught how to read this yet. I know that they're going to be able to do it, because I can tell that by the time that I've spent with them. So it's all about potential, really. And you know, we want as many children as possible within the school who show that potential, regardless of where their previous school or their previous circumstances may have actually got them to.
I mean, just talking about the family, I mean, it's how closely linked is Brighton College in Singapore to Brighton College in the UK? Can you just talk a little bit about the family of schools that are available and how they sort of integrate and how they're linked?
Yeah, of course. So I think that, you know, rightly so, Brighton are incredibly proud of their reputation in the UK and internationally. And they want to make sure that any other school that's part of their family has the same ethos and is delivering exactly the same as what you might get as if you were over in the UK. And so there's a very tight kind of network. We all have lots to do with each other. So I have lots to do with other people who are also in my role. I also speak with the education director who oversees all the schools very frequently. We discuss things like curriculum and any changes that we want to make with them. I think the other thing that we do is we make a huge effort to try and kind of keep teachers within the brand, if you like, within the family. And so this year we have teachers coming to join us from other Brighton College schools ready for August. And obviously that is to make sure that we maintain those standards that everyone expects from a Brighton College school across all of our families of schools. We also, in normal times, we would have inspection teams kind of going out to all of the schools to make sure that what we say is happening. And I'm actually a member of that team. So when things are up and running, I will also go to other Brighton schools to offer kind of my opinion, if you like, to those schools. So yeah, we're very, very close. It definitely is we are Brighton. It is a Brighton school. Our education is very in line with what you would expect from a Brighton school.
I guess that sort of that learning between the different colleges is probably a really good way to sort of signpost and sort of share best practice, I guess, in terms of learning techniques and what's happening in other parts of the world, which must be really enriching for the students.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing because, you know, we're obviously a small school at the moment. So we have a small staff room body who are all amazing, but we are small in numbers. But actually, we have a Teams link or a Zoom link or whatever you want to use to another, 200-300 teachers around the world, all of whom are teaching under the same kind of ethos as we are, all of whom are teaching under the same, family name. And it's just a really lovely thing to be able to pick up the phone and say, oh, we're thinking about doing this with our year twos, and for somebody to go, well, we tried that and that was awful, or why don't you try doing this? And yeah, it's just, for the teachers, it's an incredibly developing kind of process educationally, which obviously then has just such a massive knock-on effect to the children that we're teaching every day.
Oh, brilliant. I don't want to dwell too much on the year that we've had with COVID, but it would be remiss of me not to bring this in, because it sounds like you and the team are doing an absolutely amazing job in terms of, setting up the school, and sort of seeing that development as well. I know many schools were forced into virtual learning through the COVID pandemic, but I believe that Brighton College was still able to maintain in-person teaching. And how did you manage that? And sort of what was the thinking right at the beginning of the pandemic with so many unknowns? How did you, as a leader within the school, sort of think about the quality of the education for the kids? And how did you sort of put something in place which was going to ensure that in-person teaching was going to be maintained?
Yeah, I mean, we've been exceptionally lucky, and a lot of that is to do with our size. With us starting, we obviously had smaller numbers to start with, which meant that a lot of the restrictions that came with how many children could be in one place and all those kind of things, we just luckily managed to escape. But I think, what it did make us think of is, that could be around the corner at any second. So I suppose as we've been planning our curriculum, as we've been planning our activities, as we've been thinking about how we communicate with parents, and as we've been kind of introducing the children to different methods of learning and technology, we've always been doing that with a mindset of, okay, no one ever thought that they would ever be in a situation where most of the learning that happened in their school was online, but that could happen again at any time. So I think for us, we've been really, really lucky, and we haven't had that situation yet. And actually, our entire program has gone ahead as planned. All our specialist teachers, all our CCA has always been there from the start. But I think we are also, I suppose, in the background, have been preparing ourselves for the day when that might not happen, and making sure that we've taken the right steps and we've prepared the children for that in case we should have to go down that route.
Is it a two-way exercise, sort of helping the students in that respect? I mean, are you listening to what the kids are being driven by as well? I mean, I know that, when we're talking to some of the young generation in the community, certainly here in Singapore, there's a real push for sustainability, and they're thinking about the green agenda and the future world that they want to live and work in as well. Does that sort of flow through with all of your activity as well, Lois?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's 100%. We have no idea what we're preparing children for, like what the world's going to look like when my 8-year-olds are 18 or, 28, and they're doing their jobs. I mean, we've just got no idea. And I think that children are way more aware of those things than, I ever was when I was at school. They are talking about it all the time. They are kind of listening to the news, and they're amazed by what's kind of going on in the world around them at the moment. And because we are a small school as well, our children really have a voice within our school. So we give them an awful lot of, I suppose, soapbox time to be able to say what they would like to see in the future. We've made a really big point of saying, you're part of something really special here. Your founding students have a chance to kind of have your say. What would you like to see us do in the future? And they've talked about things like that, like sustainability. The children that we have, you know, our oldest children are only 8 and 9, so they may not put it in those terms, but they are talking about those kind of things and helping people and being in the community. And so they're giving us lots of ideas about what's important to them and what they're quite passionate about to enable us then to plan our curriculum and plan the extra activities that they do around that.
Is there anything you can share? Are there any sort of really interesting ideas coming out of the kids that you think that you're definitely going to be sort of doing in the future? Are there any sort of key themes that really seem to be coming out from the kids at Brighton College Singapore?
Yeah, so I mean, my class at the moment are huge on their animals and plastics and all those kind of things. So we've already kind of partnered with a company who offer field trips. So instead of them kind of, I think sometimes schools, when they do their outdoor education programs at the end of the year, they just, you know, they kind of go and they have a wonderful time. They do some canoeing and that's great. The kids get a lot from that. But actually our children have been talking about doing that alongside being able to go into a community and kind of help build something or beach clean and things like that. So we've already partnered with a company in Singapore who offer international trips. We're going to be quite progressive and quite out there and take the children away. And the focus is going to be on what they can give back alongside, you know, those canoeing trips and the mountaineering trips and things like that.
Oh, great stuff. So, there's a question we ask all of our guests on this, on our channel. And you've had such an amazing career, really. I mean, sort of looking at your zoology degree, you know, using that science background to then start teaching science in schools in the UK and then, you know, moving abroad. Really, really amazing. So, if we could offer you the British Chamber of Commerce time machine for a day, and with all of the stuff that you know now and your career and your knowledge and your learnings, you could go back to a point in your career where you could give yourself some advice. What would that advice be? And at what part of your career would you tell that advice to yourself?
That is a good question. Do you know, actually, and I think this might be a weird one. I think I would actually go back to where I made the decision to go internationally. I think I went internationally and I went a big step up. I went to be a head of a school for the first time. I was quite young when I did that, and I got an amazing amount from it, and it's enabled me to be where I am today. But actually, I think I would give myself the advice to do one more kind of middle leadership before I did that, because actually the shock of going from being the kind of middle leadership or even the deputy to being the person who's kind of in charge and everything that comes with that. And unfortunately, what you lose in terms of contact time with children was a big thing for me, actually. And I think that's been one of the nicest things for me being here in Singapore, is that actually I have, I suppose, taken a step down to kind of go into a deputy role. And then with everything that's happened, I went into a classroom full time, which was I wasn't expecting to do. And I've just loved being with the children again, which, is a really special thing. And I think probably that would be the one thing that I would do, is to have given myself a few more years of that before doing, I suppose, the big job.
Oh, that's really, really honest. Thank you so, so much indeed. Look, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so, so much for your time. It's been wonderful to hear about all the activities at Brighton College Singapore and your career and what you've been doing as well. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, and we hope you enjoyed today's episode. As always, don't forget to subscribe and rate our channel on Spotify, Apple, Google, and all other podcast platforms. For more information about the Chamber, please visit www.britcham.org.sg.